It's great to be here. The book has been actually already out for a little while, but it was only available as hard back, and so it was prohibitively expensive to most people. So finally it's coming out as a paper version that actually people can buy and then also read. And it's great to be here and to launch this this paper version. Let me just start out with the title of the book, Migration Borders Freedom. I think you can see it back there. Yeah, right. It's a play on words. And the play on words, I think it reflects the way that I'm approaching the book and the topic of the book. There are multiple ways in which this title can be read. First, it's just the key words of the book, and the publisher said, okay, you have to have a title that signifies the market. That's the language that was used. So if you go on the internet or you're on your library catalog, that if you punch in your keywords, that you find the book. That's what the publisher wanted. So I tried to find it to make it work somehow, this title, and we came up with this title, Migration Borders Freedom, because it also has different meanings. So it can be interpreted as a sentence, in which case borders becomes a verb. And one meaning, there are two different meanings in which way this can be read then. One meaning would be that migration creates a border around freedom. So it does not lead to greater freedom, but it's actually a limitation thereof. And think of a scenario, for example, where a person before migration has citizenship rights, and after the migration might be illegalized, not have status, and it's actually associated, migration is associated with a loss or denial of rights. Another way of reading this title could be that migration is on the border of freedom. And here I visualize a medieval European city with a bordered fortified wall, and inside the wall there would be the free citizens, and outside in the hinterland there would be the feudal serfs. And in order to gain their freedom, the serfs can migrate to the city. So it gets them very close to the city, up to the border, to the fortified wall. But then there's still the gatekeeper that says, okay, you can come in and you can't come in. So the migration takes a person, or in this case the feudal serfs, close to freedom, but not quite there. And I think this ambiguous meaning of the title also reflects my approach towards borders, migration, and the urban imagination, which is also part of the book. That all of these concepts can be interpreted in various and very different ways. But let me back off a little bit and tell you about what was the underlying motivation for writing this book and what the underlying problem is. And that is, let me try to figure, that borders have become very deadly, and border practices have deadly, more than they maybe have ever been before. This is an image from the book from the year 2015 that depicts where the deaths and missing people occurred of migrants trying to reach Europe. It shows that almost 1,500 people were confirmed to die, and more than 2,000 went missing on their way to Europe. Since 2000, there have been more than 3,000 incidents with more than 40,000 people either dead or missing. And the actual number is probably much higher because many of these incidents are not reported or completely unknown. In other parts of the world, in Australia, researchers are also counting fatalities, and then the death count since 2000 is around 2,000 known cases. Mm-hmm. In the United States, I came across the story of a forensic anthropologist. Her name is Lori Baker, and she's running a lab in Texas. And her what she does is she analyzes the DNA of migrants who died trying to cross the U.S.-Mexican border and tries to identify them in this way. And the first case were the bones of a woman that was that were found in 2003 in the Arizona desert, and she was able to identify this person, this woman, and the L.A. Times reported on this. Her name was Rosa Cano Dominguez. She was 32 years old, was a mother of two from the Yucatan region who had been traveling to work in the Pacific Northwest when she sprained her ankle, and that's when she was abandoned by her smugglers and then subsequently died. Since 2000, an estimated more than 6,000 people died at the U.S. border. Here are some of the latest figures indicating that this problem has not been solved, quite the opposite. These are the figures released by the IOM. As of last Friday, 2,744 people were unknown fatalities around the world. And again, the actual number of fatalities is probably much higher. So the problem is that border regimes, and by border regimes I mean the complex interplay between governments and administrations and their policies, civic organizations, surveillance and control technologies, but then also migrants' efforts to circumvent these technologies. They have become very deadly, and they are rivaled only by war or the worst kind of natural disaster that you can imagine, like the 2004 tsunami. And then they're not only becoming deadly, but they're also ordering our world. These regimes determine under which conditions people live and work, who has access to rights and welfare, who belongs, who does not belong, who is considered a legal person and who isn't. So these border regimes impose borders and orders, order on our community. So that was the initial problem where I started out with. And what I want to do in the next 25 minutes or so is just ask the question or address the question: How do we address this kind of problem? And I was particularly interested in what kind of visions are necessary. How can we think about the possibility of freedom of migration in which this kind of situation, that scenario that I just outlined, where this doesn't occur? And I'm not interested in the immediate policy responses. So I'm not interested in Trump's border wall or the EU's dirty deal with Turkey, Libya, or African countries, or a global compact for the safe, orderly, and regular migration. I'm more interested in the broader ideas, in the utopian possibilities, in these kind of questions that we need to ask. So I want to talk about the concept of freedom, and the concept of open borders, what it means to membership in the context of migration, and propose domicile membership, and then also zoom in on some of the practices and the policies that are heading in this direction, in particular sanctuary city policies, and I'm going to use Toronto as an example here too. But then also talk about the notion of no border, or my interpretation of this, and then wrap up with a few conclusions. And woven into this discussion is a narrative of possibility, and maybe also utopia. In the book, utopia is more, I cut a lot of this out in the presentation, but there's more utopian thinking in the book than I'm presenting today. So the first concept would be the notion of freedom. It's a concept that is quite central to modernity and modern thinking. But even in that context, it has been interpreted in various ways. It can refer to an individual type of autonomy, an autonomy to reason and to decide, so a very liberal kind of interpretation. And it relates to equality, that every person should have equal access to this type of freedom. From a social justice perspective, freedom means something else. It means, it can mean freedom from exploitation and oppression by prevailing political forces and economic structures. There are many other interpretations. I don't have time to go through them all, That would be a separate book. Foucault, for example, talks about the complex interplay between freedom on one side and power on the other side. But one person that I found very interesting for my own purposes, very useful actually, was Hannah Arendt. Mm-hmm. And her concept of freedom, and she at one point mentions freedom as the capacity to begin something new. And I think she wanted to distinguish herself from Heidegger. But the idea of beginning something new I find very, very productive. And beginning something new that didn't exist before, but also that cannot even be imagined with the type of concepts and the language that we currently have available to us. In a different context, Arendt talks about the freedom of mobility as, and mobility in particular, as the oldest and the most elementary form of freedom, and something that is also quite essential to being political, so that people need to move and migrate in order to become political subjects. So I took these kind of statements serious, or I followed them through in my own kind of research, and then ask, what do we need to, how can we think about the freedom of mobility, that all human beings should possess the freedom of mobility? And what would be the circumstances and the conditions under which we can actually exercise this freedom? And I think historically we have seen that power has always controlled mobility, and at least that's my opinion. And how can we go beyond this? And one idea that has been circulating in public debate and in the academic literature as well is the idea of open borders. And interestingly, this idea of this call for open borders has been made, especially in the academic literature, from all kinds of different ideological positions. So for example, there's a liberal position that suggests that border regulations are reinforcing a kind of birth privilege. And one of the key proponents of this is Joseph Cairns, who suggests that this is represents a kind of birth privilege. If you happen to be on this side of the border or on that side of the border, it determines your life chances. And that would be quite illiberal. So life prospects should not be dependent on the location where you're born. This open borders idea has also been argued for from a market economy perspective. And the simple argument is here that border restrictions distort the labor market, and borders are therefore inefficient. And like goods and capital, labor should also be perfectly mobile. I'm not saying that I necessarily endorse this view, but this argument has been presented. From a political economy position, borders can enforce the exploitation of labor. So borders would be a way for capital to divide and conquer a global labor force and pit workers in one country against the workers in another country. So very different ideological positions that argue for open borders. And there are other positions. From an anti-racist viewpoint, it has been argued that borders enforce a system of global apartheid. There can be a feminist argument that borders are a mechanism of gender oppression. Political court considerations would highlight the value of remittances and from that perspective argue for open borders. And even religious and faith-based positions can also support open borders. So philosophically, I think this is it's not easy to dismiss this open borders idea. And the reason I think why we don't have open borders is that borders protect the privileges of the privileged. And it's not in the interest of the privileged to open borders necessarily. And critics, of course, often dismiss this open borders idea as utopian. Mm-hmm. And just say, okay, this is utopian, but rather than arguing, they just dismiss it as unrealistic, something that is not even feasible to think about. And in the book, I discuss then more about what utopia means to me. But what I want to emphasize here is that, of course, open borders also, there's a dialectical flip side to this, can create disturbing dystopias. So open borders can create a free market utopia, for example, where employers freely exploit workers at a global scale. It could also lead to the exodus of the rich and the concentration of the poor. You know, so there are all kinds of negative consequences, and it can create as much harm as much harm as it does good. And therefore, I think we should think of this open border scenario not as a utopia, but rather more as a negation. It criticizes the world in which we live, but it does not really offer concrete utopian counterpositions. So it doesn't say, okay, an open border scenario has to look like this and this, but rather it negates this the current conditions and suggests, okay, here's what's wrong with the current conditions. And again, Joseph Cairns has articulated in this way. The open borders argument is not really intended as a concrete recommendation for current policies or one that in a foreseeable future. It is not intended as advice to presidents and prime ministers or to administrators and legislators. Rather, it serves a heuristic function, revealing to us something about the specific character of the moral flaws of the world in which we live, the institutions we inhabit, and the social situations of those who dwell in rich industrial states. I think very important to our discussion here is that we need to realize that this open border scenario makes a very important assumption. And that assumption is that borders continue to exist. Mm-hmm. And an open borders scenario suggests simply that there is, or assumes that there is a territorial nation state that has borders, but then we allow people to cross freely these borders. So it does not challenge the territorial state, and it does not challenge the Westphalian global order. It reproduces in a way John Agnew's territorial trap that suggests that we cannot, or we're not willing to imagine a world beyond the nation, the territorial nation state. So the open borders possibility, the open borders scenario, they represent the kind of possibility that we can imagine today with the concepts that we have available to think about the world, about the political community, such as the nation state, and with the concepts that we have available and the language that we have available to us at this point to think about the world and to make sense of the world. But of course, the problem is that if borders are open, then migrants can still be excluded. Earlier I talked about the dystopias that can be created, or if you in another way, that open borders might not change that much at all. A lot of research shows that borders create differences not only at the border, but also and especially inside political territories, so inside the physical border. And in this case, open borders would only reinforce maybe birth privilege. For example, when migrants are born on the wrong side of the border can be denied status or citizenship, then it would just maintain privilege and reproduce not being privileged. It can continue to distort markets and enforce labor exploitation if migrant workers aren't given the same kind of rights as everybody else has. It could permit oppression, for example, when migrants are denied political membership. So the inevitable question in this kind of open border scenario is, how do freely migrating people become members of their chosen social and political communities? So I think we have to think together my mobility and belonging. And that must be linked then, the open borders or mobility question must be linked to question of citizenship and membership in a territorial state. So how can people belong? I think one interesting question, and I think a productive answer to this, would be citizenship based on place of residence. And that brings me to the domicile principle. And the domicile principle of citizenship is different from the jus soli principle of citizenship that suggests that citizenship is based on place of birth. So when my children are born in Canada, on Canadian territory, they automatically have Canadian citizenship, independent where they're going a week after they're born, 10 years after they're born, or if they're stayed. So it's a birthright kind of citizenship. It's also different from jus sanguinis, which is citizenship based on ancestry. So if my children are born to a German citizen or a Canadian citizen, then they automatically inherit these kind of both citizenships as well. The domicile principle suggests that that citizenship should be tied to your residence, so to your domicile. And there are lots of examples in history. France, after the French Revolution, implemented that kind of citizenship practice and principle. Or here are the member states of the German Empire, but of course only within the German Empire. In a contemporary context, naturalization practices are often emulating the domicile principle. In Canada, for example, a landed immigrant can receive citizenship after 3 to 5 years being in Canada. But the problem is that membership is probationary in many cases, especially for immigrants and mobile people. And of course, membership can be manipulated. Access to membership is routinely manipulated by the state. So think of, for example, about temporary foreign labor programs, especially here in Canada, where people are here, they are present on Canadian territory, but of course they're systematically excluded from gaining access to these rights and citizenship. Or illegalized populations that are de facto members of our communities, but they are denied equal rights and status. So the problem is that the state manipulates these access to membership based on the domicile principle. Let me provide you with an example of a situation where migrants have claimed and asserted domicile citizenship rights. And I'm thinking here in the context of, it's been a little while, more than a decade, but in 2006 there were massive migrant protests in numerous U.S. cities. And these protests occurred in response to a proposed federal law, the so-called Sensenbrenner Bill. And what this bill would have done it would have made it a felony just to be an illegalized person, and it would have made it a felony also to provide assistance, including humanitarian assistance, to illegalized migrants. Here we happen to have a geography conference in downtown Chicago. I think that most of the academic geographers had no idea what was going on outside because they were locked up in their conference venue. But if you stepped outside, you were in the middle of these protests, the largest protests that the U.S. apparently has ever seen up to the point. In Chicago, there were 100,000 people on the street, and the ones in Dallas and Los Angeles were even larger, with 500,000 people. And these protests occurred in multiple cities throughout the country. And what I found very interesting is that these protesters asserted, and many of them were illegalized migrants, asserted their belonging by evoking these nationalist symbols. Yeah. So here you see the national flags of Mexico and of course especially the U.S. As they marched through the streets, they sang the U.S. national anthem. They proclaimed to be Americans, and their speeches mm-hmm. ended with "God bless America." So I found it, on the one hand, I found it strange that they did not demand the abolition of the state that disenfranchises them, but then I understood their tactics, that they validated the nation first, that was the first step through these symbols, and then they said, okay, but we want to be part of it too, because we belong here based on the domicile principle. We are part of the society too. Oh, I missed the slide. You were waiting for the slide. These are the projects, yeah.
<There it is.
laughs> Okay. But we can also think of this principle on other scales. And I'm already moving on to the next slide. I think belonging has historically often been expressed at the urban scale, not at the national scale, because the nation state is actually a political construction that's not that old. And the urban scale might be a much more intuitive scale where people express their belonging, politically or otherwise. And here I want to return to this figure of the walled medieval European city that I mentioned earlier. If you're able to enter it, so if the gatekeeper actually lets you in and you're able to breathe this free air or this city air for 1 year plus 1 day, then you would become a free citizen. Okay. So in this case, we had the implementation of the domicile rule at the urban scale within the city context. And today we see that urban activist initiatives are again challenging the nation state and the national scale of migration and belonging, and are arguing for the domicile kind of principle at the urban scale. And this brings me to a more contemporary context, and that's much more relevant to our city here. The Sanctuary City movement that has had for some time now, considerable successes in U.S. cities, so in Baltimore, Chicago, San Francisco, and dozens of other U.S. cities that have passed sanctuary legislation. Typically, that involves banning the use of municipal resources to enforce federal immigration-related laws, to prohibit city employees from collecting and disseminating information on resident status or inhabitant status, and to ensure that the delivery of municipal services occurs to everyone that lives and inhabits the city, independent of citizenship or status. From the U.S., the Sanctuary City movement spread across the border to Canada, and of course we know what happened in Toronto in 2013, even though corresponding policies were already in place in Toronto. At an earlier point, in 2013, City Council voted in Toronto to effectively become a sanctuary city. And that was then followed more recently by similar initiatives in Hamilton, Vancouver, Montreal, and other cities as well. And the domicile principle does, in that case, not only apply to the formal state and the municipality. So I think in this case we have a very interesting example where the domicile principle is applied to a context where an infrastructure, if you want, the municipal and the municipality, a city council, a territorial municipality that delivers services within municipal boundaries that existed and could be utilized and used to implement a kind of policy that implements the domicile rule. But I think this domicile principle also applies to different layers of possibilities or different kinds of possibility. And that brings me to the concept of solidarity, which has also been an important context in my research and in the book. And what we've seen, linking this to the sanctuary city initiatives, is that implementing the sanctuary city policy in Canada and in Toronto also required a great deal of solidarity between all kinds of different actors. And it's on the one hand the illegalized migrants themselves and migrants without status or precarious status, but then also the voting citizens and the representatives in city council. They're in very different positions, but in this case they share a political stage, and I think that was very important. And again, they're using the existing infrastructure in the form of a municipality and a territorial political organization to initiate policies that would implement this domicile principle. But this same solidarity has been put to very different use to pursue all kind of different altogether different aim and a different kind of possibility, I would label that. And I struggled with a proper label for this type of possibility. And I'm talking about a possibility that doesn't use existing concepts or an existing kind of language or an existing kind of political infrastructure, but something that goes a step further or multiple steps further. And I looked at some of the literature or the writings of Ernst Bloch, a German philosopher, and he called it actually the objectively real possibility, and he has different labels, quite complex, and I didn't think that it would be a very user-friendly label, so I created my own, and I called it Possibilia. In philosophy, it actually exists, a term, and it means things that don't exist, but it's not heavily used. You really have to look hard to actually find it applied in the literature. But I like the term because it's snappy, it's simple, but it also connects in an interesting way utopia and possibility. Okay. And this possibilia exists, it's a possibility, a real possibility that lies beyond the kind of infrastructure and the concept and the language that we have available to us at the moment. And I would associate this kind of possibilia with the idea of no border. Mm-hmm. And that differs. We very much have to distinguish this possibility, this no border idea, from the open borders idea. In the literature, sometimes you find this conflated, and I would like to analytically separate the two. Recall, the open border scenario assumes very much that there is a territorial nation state that has borders, political borders, and simply that these borders are open and free for people to cross. But it doesn't challenge the nation state or the Westphalian order. The no border idea does exactly that. It rejects the bordered national, territorial nation state, and it assumes that borders are a mechanism, a fundamental mechanism of oppression, and we need to think beyond the territorial nation state and beyond the Westphalian order, but then we kind of begin lacking the concepts and the language to do that. At least that's my interpretation. So the no border exists at a different layer of possibility, which I would then label, or have labeled in the book, possibilia. And this possibility assumes that the political, social, and economic circumstances of this no border world, it doesn't yet exist. And the not yet, this is a language that is also used by Ernst Bloch when he uses this different kind of terminology. And the concepts and the way that we think about the world, that we have available to us to think about the world, they also do not yet exist. And that differs from the open borders scenario or from the sanctuary city, for that matter, which are quite imaginable with the concepts and the language that we have available to us. Richard Anderson and her colleagues describes, and Cynthia was part of this too, describes the No Border Project in this way. A no border calls challenge nation states' sovereign right to control people's mobility and signal a new sort of liberatory project, one with new ideas of society and one aimed at creating new social actors not identified with national projects. And I think this no border world we should imagine, or we should not think of this no border world that we can create through academic musing, through constructing theories, or that we can go to the drawing board and can kind of cook up how this no border world would look like, but rather that would be guided by social practice and collective social practice. So we have to look at some of the contexts in which these practices occur. And this is again where these practices of solidarity become very interesting, where practices of solidarity are occurring between people who are denied the freedom of migration, those who are illegalized and disenfranchised, but also the citizens that share and people with status and all kinds of different in different kind of circumstances that are sharing a political stage. And here one example might be this is an image. I got the right image, yeah. Of the May Day, one of the May Day rallies right here in Toronto, and I find a very interesting kind of coalition between activists that belong to networks such as No One Is Illegal and Solidarity City, but also labor unions, anti-poverty advocates, but also indigenous groups that, you know, we are being told have a very different approach towards belonging than migrants, for example, in the settler society. And by acting in solidarity, these coalitions reject and transcend the categories of migrant and indigenous, or citizen and non-citizen. And they are creating new subjectivities. And that's then creating these possibilities in front of our eyes. I'm almost close to ending. So I've taken you on a journey from open borders towards belonging to the domicile principle, talking about the sanctuary cities, solidarity, and then eventually no border, and woven in there was possibilia, and I spared you from talking about utopia. But what it comes down to, I think, is that we need to radically reimagine borders, migration, and belonging. And in this context, you find all kinds of contradictions. And in the book, I uncovered all kinds of contradictions. And I don't think we need to be afraid of these contradictions. Often we at the universities, we're told that, well, if you have ideas that contradict each other, then there must be something wrong with your theory. But I think no, it doesn't have to be. It's actually great, because contradiction is actually it represents a dialectical moment that forces us to think beyond these existing categories. And I think that's what we need to do. And unless we do that, I think borders will continue to kill people, like I presented as we've seen in the images and maps that I presented at the beginning, and they will continue ordering our world in a way that we don't want. And I'll leave it here. Thank you very much for listening, and I look forward to your comments. Yeah.